Hey everyone, welcome to Your Amigos podcast. Tom and I are here with Silke Gillison, our fellow Your Amigo, Your Amiga. And we're going to talk about the upcoming APCCC meeting that Silke, that you run. And so maybe we can start with, Silke, give us a little bit of the background of the meeting and how it started and where is it. And it also has a very interesting structure around questions. So maybe just give us a little primer on the meeting to start.
Yes, so we started in reality planning in 2013, so quite exactly 10 years ago now. And in reality, we took the idea from early breast cancer, the consensus meeting, the quite famous consensus meeting from St. Gallen that now takes place in Vienna because St. Gallen is too small. And we thought, you know, maybe there's also a place for it in prostate cancer. Because the idea actually from this meeting is that we don't discuss evidence where evidence is clear, but we take clinical situations that we see kind of every day in the tumor board or in the clinics, and we don't have good evidence to lead us, to help us with doing treatment decisions. So these are the kind of questions that we are asking.
So you pick clinically controversial areas to discuss.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Who, like, who picks it? Is it a team? Is it you? Is that?
So it's actually a team. So we are starting with Aurelio Sommelin and I do the first draft. Then we do in a little group with Nick James, Karim Fizazi, Bertrand Tombal, and this time Thomas Silly. We do a second round of questions. So we kind of optimize the questions. And mm-hmm. then we send it around to all the panelists that are like more than 120 this year.
And then and you come up with a refined list of these questions. And how is there a number you're shooting for? Like you want 4, you want 10, or is it just?
to be honest, we always try to be around 120, but then we always come up with more. Last time it was almost 200. So we decided
200 questions?
This time. Yeah. So this time we, you know, because you think about something, then you always like, you'd think, oh, maybe we should ask that a bit more refined. And then, you know, in the end, you're always having more questions than you wanted. So, but right now we are at about 120, 140.
And the goal is to provide an answer to each of those questions, or at least not necessarily, because there's not going to be consensus to all those questions, right?
So no, interestingly, like in the last years, it was actually half-half, right? In half of the questions, we get consensus, but also in a lot of questions, we don't get consensus.
So, Suki, 120 people vote. How do you pick them? And how come me and Brian aren't on the list?
That's the tip of all of our listeners.
How on earth have they managed to do this without Brian and Tom so far?
Maybe because it's not about kidney cancer.
Fair point. So, very fair.
So that's why. In reality, so we try to be, you know, to have people on board who really do a lot of clinics in this disease. So it's really more about how much clinical experience do you have. And then also we have obviously all the panelists who have a lot of literature, who have written a lot of the papers, who are like the key players in prostate cancer. But we have also some people who are like just like really good clinicians. Mm-hmm. Because that's important, right? Because it's very clinical questions. So what are you doing with the patient who stands in front of you? And then also we try to be a bit diverse, to be international. So we have really from every country. We have one or two panelists, depending. We have a lot more from the UK and the US, I have to say, because obviously a lot of the famous key players in prostate cancer come from these countries, but we try to be kind of diverse.
But distinctly not Tom and I. They come from these countries.
But yes. But not. I feel even more excluded. So, Suki, next quick question. It was used to be, you used to have it in St. Gallen, or was it St. Gallen, or was it Zurich? And now it's in Lugano. Where does the actual meeting take place?
So this time it's in Lugano. Last time it was in Lugano because I'm now in Lugano. So
Great swimming pool, Brian, in Lugano. Our listeners might not know, but actually Brian's a very fast swimmer, or I'm a very slow swimmer. It hasn't quite decided yet. We've not swum against anyone else. It's just me and him. So Brian, you'd be pleased to know that there's a terrific swimming pool. So
excellent.
Excited about
I can't
that.
Wait.
Silky, one of the things I'm really interested in when I look at this is it's very hard to generate questions without coming up with quite ambiguous answers. You know, in guidelines, we try and kind of we put it to panels, and it often ends up by the question people saying, you know, there are always circumstances where I wouldn't do this, and you know, never say never, and all the other bits and pieces. How do you make sure that the questions are fit for purpose?
So to be honest, we learned a lot from our colleagues from breast cancer. So Beat Tuleman, who's very involved in the breast cancer meeting, helped us a lot to not make too many mistakes, you know, so not to ask like, in which patients would you consider, because consider doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. So you can consider everything and everyone. So we try to make...
Except Morris dancing and oysters. Never. So
what?
They should,
focus.
They
focus.
Should never be considered.
Okay. Okay. But you know what I mean? It's kind of, we try to be really kind of clear in the questions. And this is why we concentrate very much on the questions. So we do 3 rounds of questions. So we let people really comment on them if they are clear, if they know what they would vote for. And that was quite difficult, as you say. So you, obviously you have to go for the majority of patients because, I mean, you will never do one thing in every patient and so on. But then we are very clear with the recommend. So what would you really do? I think that's the main point.
The goal is to come up with a consensus or at least discussion around these clinical scenarios. In terms of what you would you do in clinic, right? I mean, that's what it's really all about, is the patient's in front of you with this scenario, what would you do? Not, I'd consider this or I can do that, but to be concrete about, you know, the action that you would take in this particular patient. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. So we have also 2.5 days of where we have really like presentations about exactly these topics. Because now, you know, like, after EMBARK, we see that the enzalutamide monoarm did induce a lot of gynecomastia, right? A lot of us don't know any longer about gynecomastia.
Go really slowly for me, Silky. Now, Brian and I are both prostate cancer experts. But let's just go through the EMBARK bit really slowly. So what's the EMBARK trial? Because that's something that's new, and I guess that's something that you're going to talk a lot about at the meeting. So what were the results? What was the design of the EMBARK study, and how do you think it's going to influence practice, and what questions are you asking around EMBARK?
Yeah, the EMBARK trial is really a trial that is very new since 2022. So obviously that is something where we will have a lot of questions about. And it's actually in a population of high-risk patients with biochemical relapse without imaging relapse. So it's really biochemical relapse. Only that this study was done, again, in a time with conventional imaging. Mm-hmm. So we actually don't know what these patients would have had when they would have had a PSMA PET, for example. So again, this is going to generate a lot of questions, right? So then the question was 3 arms, high-risk biochemical relapse, giving ADT alone, what is the standard of care, enzalutamide alone, or the combination. And the data was quite convincing and very interesting because the combination was the most efficient in point of MFS. But then the enzalutamide monoarm seemed to be better than the ADT alone, what was quite surprising. And I think for most of us also a bit surprising, the enzalutamide arm didn't have less toxicity. It had different toxicity, but not less toxicity. So that was quite interesting. And I guess now we have to, because the FDA, Brian, you know that very well, has now approved very recently both the combination arm and the enzalutamide mono therapy in these cases. So I guess it's, you know, it's quite interesting what people would do now.
So you take those data and then what questions are you going to ask at the conference? I mean, give us just like an example, maybe not an exhaustive list, but an example of what would you ask around that? I mean, I guess the obvious one is, would you give combination or monotherapy?
Yeah, exactly. So that's one of the obvious ones. But then also the question, what would you do now with the patients who are PSMA, have one lesion in PSMA? Yeah. So, you know, so probably conventional negative, but we don't know. So it's not exact. So, but these are the patients we see now because, you know, in most countries that have PSMA PET available, they do in biochemical relapse, specifically these high-risk relapses, a PSMA PET.
Sure. And so, what's the number? I should know this, but I don't. What's the number if you take this high-risk population that's conventional negative? How many will have an abnormal PSMA PET? What percentage?
We don't know because this is a really specific population with a very fast PSA doubling time and imaging, conventional right. imaging negative. So, you know, it could be 50%, could be 60%,
yeah.
where you see something in PSMA, right?
It's suspected so, pretty high, yeah.
Yeah. So what are we doing now with these patients, right? Should we treat them like metastatic? Should we treat them like the high-risk relapse? I mean, the big difference is that EMBARK, and I think that's really quite interesting, did the intermittent therapy, right? Mm-hmm. So for the patients who had a good response, they then stopped the therapy. So that, I mean, it's quite important difference to what we do in metastatic disease, where we at least standard as a standard don't stop the therapies, don't use intermittent therapies for whatever reasons. So you know, I think we can discuss also that, but it's quite interesting. So that will be a bit the questions, you know.
Okay, Silky, there's areas of controversy here. You've gone straight into the radiotherapy issue. I can see there are questions around the role of radiation therapy with abiraterone and the Stampede study and the PEACE study came up with different results there. Are you expecting any consensus in that area? Are you taking on these controversial areas because you feel you will get consensus, or do you think that actually some of these areas are just too controversial? And what happens if you don't get consensus? Is that just a question that's buried? Or what do you do in those areas? How do you process the results when you don't come to a conclusion?
I mean, having no consensus is in a way a conclusion, right? So no, we're not going to bury the results because we are like writing a long manuscript where we detail the voting results. So very transparent. So you can actually see in the publications who voted for what, or not who, but how many of the panelists voted for what, for which option. So I think, you know, in reality, everywhere where we have non-consensus, I think that could be a good area where we should do more research.
How do you define consensus? Is it above a certain percentage of agreement?
It's 75% or more 75. Of the panelists going for one answer option.
And how many of the 120 questions do you typically achieve consensus on?
Yeah, about half of them.
About half, yeah.
Because we're using the controversial. You know, from that, what Tom said, you know, we are exactly going, we're not asking these questions. We're going to ask these questions because the question now is really with the local radiotherapy in the low volume disease with PEACE-1 having a bit different results from Stampede.
Why are they different? Sure. How do you account for the differences? What's your take on it?
Right. So you know that Stampede and also the meta-analysis from Stampede and Horridge showed an OS benefit in patients with low volume disease or low burden disease treated with local radiotherapy. But in these two trials, we had mostly patients with ADT only in the standard of care arm.
Yeah.
And now PEACE-1 has the question also of radiotherapy, local radiotherapy. But they had also another question adding abiraterone, yes or no. And then now, like, at least we haven't seen the data really published, but in the report from Alberto Bossi, we saw that obviously the radiotherapy in the low volume patients in this trial didn't have an OS benefit. It's a small group of patients, but I guess we have to really wait for the results and then look at the meta-analysis. But maybe it's also not that important, the OS, because the failure-free survival was really improved by adding the local radiotherapy, interestingly. And then also in the PEACE 1 trial, we saw very nicely that the local complications were reduced, even the high volume patients. So, you know, now we have a lot of these questions, right? Would you still add radiotherapy, even if you give a doublet ADT plus one of the R-PEACE? So would you still add the radiotherapy?
And what's your practice, Sokhi? I'm just curious. Are you routinely adding radiotherapy?
Yeah, Brian, I'm mostly doing it.
Yeah.
So we are, you know, and that was interestingly also in 2022, most people would do it.
Plus because LHRH, it's really not Abby very toxic. Radiotherapy. It's the triplet of LHRH, Abby plus radiotherapy. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be, yeah, a triplet, not a systemic triplet, but a triplet.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in 2022, that was also a consensus when we asked that question. But then we didn't have the PEACE 1 data. Now we have the PEACE 1 data and we have to see what people... We will have the same question again.
So that's going to change people's mind. I can see that question's there. The other questions I'm excited about, I'm quite excited about these. You didn't have very many questions, Lutetia, on the previous questionnaire in 2022. But now you've got a lot of questions on the vision and the PSMA-4 study. This is going to be an area of controversy. What are you expecting to get from there? I mean, there are about half a dozen questions on that. A lot of it actually is around the biomarker.
Yes, so I think that's really a quite interesting question because now we see these patients and the question is really specifically after only an RP and not a taxane. Would you give lutetium? In which patients would you give lutetium? Only the ones that are not fit for chemotherapy or in all of them? What would you use as your eligibility criteria? Would you go for, do you need an FDG PET together with the PSMA PET or is the PSMA PET alone? There's people who say you don't need a PSMA PET because so many patients are positive. You know, so this is quite, let's say, the questions that we're going to ask because we don't know.
So do you intentionally try to ask some of the same questions from the previous meeting or you do?
Yeah.
And how, probably not a lot, but there's probably some that might have different answers, right, as new data comes out.
Exactly. So we have, like, we kind of remake of some of the questions that where we have now new data.
You've got four questions on first-line triplet therapy, Silky, for crying out loud. Yeah. I mean, four.
Because it's still an open question. I mean, I don't know, Brian, what you are doing because...
Brian knows what he's doing, to be honest, half the time.
Thank you. Thanks for that, Tom. I don't think it's triplet
therapy. I just knocked him out the
better
car.
Than you, but
he's underarm bowling for me.
I don't give a ton of triplet therapy, Silky. I mean, I thought I would when the data came out, but I just in clinic, I don't see those patients a lot. You know, and I don't mean just volume. I just don't see a lot of patients who I think are suitable for triplet therapy. And I'm not sure what the practice is. I sense it's a little bit all over the map.
Yeah, I think most people really go for the de novo high volume patients.
Yeah.
If anything, and if they fit enough. I don't know, to be honest, like a lot of patients also say no if you make the suggestion. because, you know, if you say you can have the triplet and maybe it's better, but we don't have the real data like comparing. But we're giving quite a lot because some patients say, oh, let's try, and then it goes quite well. I think, you know, most of people would give G-CSF with it. I think that's also one of the questions, right? Should you really from the beginning add G-CSF on? Because there is quite a risk in that setting that then you have fever neutropenias. And obviously you really have to be very careful because that's a kind of still elderly patient population.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions that are geared to patients? I mean, I guess none of the panel are patients, right? Are there patient advocates or no?
Yes, there's there's a patient advocate from the UK will be there all the time. So we have a lot of questions in reality about the side effects of therapies. You know, hot flushes, like something that is so difficult. Testosterone supplementation, what's a very hot question in patients mm-hmm. who have had ADT and are now kind of in a radical setting and don't feel well. So you know, should you do that? Shouldn't you do that with someone with a history of prostate cancer? I think, you know, we're gonna go a lot of these are probably questions that, you know, we don't have any sexy new drugs, but it's really bothersome for patients. The hot flushes, the gynecomastia, and we're gonna discuss that in the meeting, but also in the questions.
I mean, I find, and I don't have a huge prostate practice, but some, Tom, you'll be happy to know. The most difficult things for me are the supportive care things. Like deciding what to give patients is relatively straightforward, but it's the bone density and when do I give, you know, when do I worry and give bisphosphonate, you know, it's things like that, that to me, you know, that are more challenging in practice.
I totally agree. I mean, really, the bone-targeted agents is such a huge question, right? Because we saw at ESMO the new data that came out from Stampede that really show a huge incidence of fractures, even in the M0 patients later in life. So I think we don't do enough. We don't have good data. You know, and there was a lot of, you know, controversy about that. And we're going to re-ask these questions. Should we actually give everyone who we plan to give long-term ADT bisphosphonates, even in the M0 patients who get 3 years of ADT? Because it seems that the fracture rate in the future is really increased.
Silky, lots of questions on PARP inhibition, BRCA1/2 versus HLR, huge numbers of questions, controversy, Propel, etc. What's your take at the moment? Where are you using PARP inhibition? Are you using it in which patient populations, and which drug are you using?
So, I mean, for Arch, is also a bit an approval thing. So I'm personally giving it to patients with BRCA 1 and 2 mutations, and sometimes in patients with PALB2, because I think this is the strongest data we have. Although, obviously, the strongest data is really in the BRCA mutated patients. As monotherapy, I guess most of us would now give it after 1 RP. The big question from Propel and so on is, you know, should you give the combination in patients? And also here, I think if someone didn't have an RP in the hormone sensitive setting. And also here, I think, yes, in the BRCA mutated patients for sure, because they had a really bad PFS, if you look at Propel, for example. In all the other mutations, I think that the data is just not very strong.
So, okay, I'm almost done. Got a couple of things I'd like to say. The first is, inevitably, people pursue their clinical experience, and you're getting experts who are coming on with clinical experience, but not everyone has the same access to drugs and the same clinical experience. And in a lot of our guideline groups, even when we say, you know, it's not about money, people vote, well, I haven't used that, so I'm not going to do that. You know, how, within the context of a global group with huge amounts of heterogeneity, do you actually get the right answer rather than the answer which is most readily available?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair question. So we have the premise that in all our questions that everything is readily available, diagnostics and treatments, what is obviously not the reality. But if you would have everything available, what would you do? And then we have also some specific questions about, you know, situations where we don't have everything available. So would you give carboplatin if you don't have access to a BARP inhibitor, for example? Would you give abiraterone 250 milligrams with food if you don't have, you know, access to 1 gram? I think we have these questions as well, because we have also one session in the meeting about, you know, the problems in countries that are low or low middle income countries that don't have all everything available as we have.
I think, Tom, I think you were asking, though, how much of that lack of access for each of these people voting might influence their answer.
Sure.
Even if they say, yeah, if I had it available, I would. But we're all shaped by our clinical experience of what we've used, and we had good experiences and bad experiences. So do you, how much do you think that influences, or do you think people can truly say, well, I don't have access to this, but I would choose it?
I guess some, yes, sometimes you can. I mean, if you really kind of concentrate on, you know, on the data that we have and so on. But I mean, you're totally right. If you don't have, it's difficult because you don't have the experience. And then, right. And we saw that also in some of the other meetings, that sometimes there's also some very weird answers, and that may be because people didn't have access. Yeah. And that's why we have 120 experts.
Yeah.
So with, you know, if the number is big enough, I think that should be leveled out.
Suki, do you get two votes or a veto like in the United Nations?
No, but so nobody got two votes. But maybe if you would be present, maybe you should think about it.
Do you get to vote anybody off?
I would come if I could get two votes.
But anyway, but no, we have, and that's really important, because that's, I think it's very important you say that, we have one thing that is abstain, and in this abstain there is also included that you don't have experience. So one of the things that, you know, one of the answers to what you said before is that you can, if you don't have experience, if you, let's say, are a radio oncologist and there's a question about third line mCRPC, you should vote abstain because you don't have experience. So we leave that option open, because we have, or, you know, a medical oncologist who doesn't know about radiotherapy schedules shouldn't go and vote for which schedule he or she would use. So I think, you know, we have that possibility, and we see that the panelists are quite honest using
that's
it.
That's reassuring.
So yeah, it was quite fun, Tom. You would find it fun, because last time we asked the question, you know, would you recommend to do G8 screening for patients over 70, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And everyone is like, yeah, consensus, you should do that. And then we asked, so who's doing it like regular in the clinical practice? And they were very honest, because then it was like 20%, right? Because nobody's like, really only few people really doing it in clinical practice every day.
Okay, my last question. What's the one question you're most excited about? Put you on the spot. There one where you're like, man, I can't wait. That's going to be so controversial, or I'm so interested in the responses. Is there one?
Yeah, I'm actually totally interested. And that sounds now not very interesting. What people would vote for to treat hot flushes? Because as you said, I mean, I think that is really something where we have no phase 3 data. It's so frequent in women and in men, right? And some men are so bothered. And we will see what patients, what the panelists say.
Silky, my last question. In all the meetings over the years, what's your favorite moment so far?
Oh, my God. That's difficult to say, because, you know, I think that it's just like, it's a really nice meeting, because people are in a very good mood, and it's a lot of discussion. I think one of the most memorable was when we were at one of the votings, and the patient advocate said to Howard Chair that, because we asked the question if we should try to cancel the word castration resistant, because patients don't like it. And then Howard Chair said it's not possible, because all the approvals are done this way with mCRPC. And then the patient advocate was giving like a big talk that this is not true, and he knows it exactly, and we should stop using castration. And that was quite cool. And we had a long discussion afterwards.
So, okay, how do you, if you're not part of the panel, you can still go to the meeting. Is that right?
Yes, of course.
Yes. Talk about if you were, if like Brian and myself, we were planning to come along. How would we...
Let's, for example, Tom and myself, yes. Yeah. This is a random example. We wanted to show up on an hour.
I'm asking for a friend, Silky. I'm asking for a friend. How would we go about doing it if Brian and I were keen to come? Who would we need to speak to? How does someone go to the meeting?
So it's quite easy. So you can register on the website. So www.appcc, so 3Cs.org. And you can just register, and you don't have to be a super expert. You don't have to be invited. A lot of people still think that. But you can just register if you're interested in the management for patients with prostate cancer.
Tom and I are going to register and come, and I'm going to lobby for us to to be able to vote.
I'm
at least me, because I see prostate.
Maybe 2026.
What?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh no, and then Tom has two votes. Oh my God! No, we have to rethink that.
No, it needs to be the whole thing. The whole voting system would need to be rethought if Brian and I were included. there needs to be a veto, like in the United Nations, as I mentioned before, and careful monitoring of voting. So look, Silky, this is very exciting. Thanks very much for coming, and it's lovely to chat to you. Good luck with the meeting, and for those people who want to join, clearly jump on the website. That sounds super cool.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.